From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today on the program, we're talking about a new book that asks whether the LDS Church really is an international church. And technically, of course it is. More than half of the world's Mormons live outside the United States. But the scholars Gina Colvin and Joanna Brooks say almost all of the decisions in the church are made by a small group of white, mostly American older men. So what does that mean for saints of different cultures? We'll be right back.
KUER is a family, so let's stay in touch. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and we'll keep you in the know about breaking news happening in Utah. We'll invite you to films and parties, and you'll even see funny pictures of us sometimes. Best of all, we'll get to hear from you. Tell us what you care about in your community, and get to know your fellow public radio nerds. Follow KUER on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Of course, Mormonism isn't the only Christian faith that sent missionaries around the world to baptize people and then ended up disconnecting them from their culture. In fact, in a new book, the scholars Gina Colvin and Joanna Brooks say that for many hurting and dislocated people around the world, Mormonism actually represented stability and security and access to education and this appealing worldview, this idea of Zion, a place for the pure in heart and a gathering of people all equal in the eyes of God. Colvin and Brooks argue that in the first several decades, Mormonism was really good at letting people keep their culture and traditions, but over time, they say, as church leaders tried to make the faith more mainstream, it also became more corporate and more rigid and more American. Mormonism seems thoroughly American these days, but more than half the religion lives outside the United States. So Brooks and Colvin have put together a collection of essays to highlight the stories of Latter-day Saints who also happen to be Polynesian and African and Latino and Indigenous. The book is called Decolonizing Mormonism. Joanna Brooks is a scholar of American culture and religion and associate vice president of faculty at San Diego State University. Gina Colvin is a New Zealand Maori scholar. She's also a research fellow at the University of Canterbury. Gina says the idea for this book began with a conversation.
I became interested in Joanna because she appeared on Radio New Zealand with Catherine Ryan several years ago. And I thought, this is somebody that can actually speak outside from the margins. And so I don't know how we got together. You'd just published a book, but we were sitting together at the UVU at a conference, Mormon Studies conference at UVU. And we're watching two well-known Mormon Studies professors or researchers and thinkers. And we thought, this is just one big male pissing competition. And we're kind of missing the point. The point is that this church is actually much, much more than how it presents in the Wasatch Front. What does this mean when we ask questions about the LDS church? What does it mean to the most vulnerable, the poorest woman in the globe? And how what's its legacy? What's its colonial legacy? Because this conversation that is very patriarchal, very white, very Utah, is just a go-round. It goes around and around and around, and it sort of borders on apologetics to mitigate for the sunk costs of men who have the most privilege in the church.
Yeah. I want to get at what you mean by costs here in a second. There was something I wanted to point out that I noticed in the very brief acknowledgement section up front, because I thought it was great, because it illustrated to me a kind of tone, and it's funny, but not also not really tongue-in-cheek, and it seemed to convey a kind of attitude that I wanted to at least ask you about. And you write this, you write, the editors would not like to acknowledge the deep pockets of white, upper, middle-class Mormon men who have a penchant for commissioning books from other white, upper, middle-class Mormon men. We have not received a red cent for this project. Our reward is in solidarity and in heaven. But would you talk a little bit about that attitude? Because I think, and I don't mean attitude in the bad way, it's just like it seems like that tone is kind of present throughout.
Well, I think that's a tone, you're hearing joy. And I fell in love with Gina, like so many people do, because of the courage and brilliance of her voice, and to finally be hearing voices like hers break through saved me and saves, I think, all of us, and saves our conversation in Mormonism from this go-round, this eternal, you know, cycle of, is it true or not? Well, the fact is it's meaningful, and it's meaningful all over the world, and we have a responsibility to hear each other. And finally hearing voices like Gina's breakthrough made me so, so happy. And so we really did develop over the years a relationship in which we would share work and post each other's work and boost each other's work. We do want to move the center of our conversations. We want to move the center of our conversations as a faith community, as a community of writers and thinkers. And we don't think it serves most Mormons, the issues that are preoccupying us at the cultural center. They don't serve. They don't uplift, speak to the hearts of, or speak to the material needs of the people we are responsible to as brothers and sisters around the world. And that's not to discount the preoccupations of the upper middle class white Mormon men at the cultural center we referenced. Those matter too. We've all given a lot to be a part of the Mormon movement. We all have. But every conversation gets richer when voices like Gina's and the people who've contributed to this book are in it.
Tell me what you're seeing. Give us a sense of the status quo that you're responding to. One of the things you write in the book, Mormon wealth and authority is profoundly and exclusively concentrated in a narrow geographical band in the United States. Almost all of the LDS Church's business decisions are made by a very small cohort of white, aged Mormon men who hail from elite Mormon families.
We are members of a church, those of us who are LDS church members, that has formed itself during the 20th century as a corporation. And it formed itself as a corporation in response to some very direct governmental threats to its very existence. We had a good reason for doing Mormonism as a corporation in the 20th century. But like all American corporations, the way we did it was bureaucratic. It was exclusive. It focused on resources management, and those resources decisions were made behind closed doors by a small number of executives. It was not inclusive of ground up feedback incorporated. It was very top down. It was a time when we correlated and coordinated and reduced the complexity of our theology and of our scriptural teachings, and in order to distribute them effectively worldwide. And that is a colonial model for doing things, right? When you say, we've got the handbook right here in Salt Lake and everything is perfectly organized, we are bureaucratically enormous and well articulated, and now Third World implement it, or now Global South implement it, or now rest the world, implement our instructions down to the point we're going to send you the folding chairs from Salt Lake City, like the same kind, you know. And that's how the church grew globally, through a colonizing apparatus. You know, we are not the United States government. The LDS Church is not the United States government, but it has behaved in ways very parallel to any corporate entity that has established itself on a global scale.
So how does that play out then when you have this centralized institution in the Intermountain West of the United States? What does that mean in any other place in terms of the way people experience faith or devotion? I mean, what are the practical effects of those things, do you think?
When you go outside of the United States, you see the plan and being implemented, but there's very little mechanism whereby we can actually monitor the effects of that. But I suppose more broadly speaking, take the political question. In the United States, church is becoming more broadly divided across the progressive conservative spectrum. And Mormons here in Utah divide themselves along whether or not you're a Republican and a Democrat. Yeah. Now, that conversation is so noisy and so overwhelming that in a small place like New Zealand, we're having to make religious decisions about whether or not what is a Democrat and what is a Republican. And if we had this president who was a member of the John Birch Society, does that now behoove us to think about race in the way that that person did?
Because that has nothing to do
it has
with
to
what's
do
going
this.
On in
no.
New Zealand.
No.
Or for that matter, and just go down the litany of other countries. Obviously.
Right. And we don't have Democrats and Mormon Democrats and Mormon Republicans in New Zealand.
Yeah.
It's a nonsense. I mean, you're a nation that doesn't really have a left wing. We're a country that has like a very robust left wing. So, you know, how do we make sense of all of this fighting and this arguing that's going on here?
And then that the need then, the responsibility that is placed on congregations in New Zealand or in Peru for sorting out the drama in America then stands in place of and takes resources that should be directed towards how do these communities live better lives? How do they have better access to health care, education, basic standard of living for their children and families? How have American corporations and American government impacted the well-being of people's lives around the world? And that is a spiritual question. Inequity is a spiritual question. So the preoccupations at the center not only get foisted upon, you know, the margins, they take up space that the margin, resources the margins should have for repairing their communities, for loving themselves and restoring their well-being.
And contextualizing, understanding what are the important political, social, and cultural issues of this particular geographical space. There is never an opportunity to contextualize. So we're, you know, we're on a program, we've got lessons that need to be taught. And I take the situation in Rwanda, where a lot of Protestant churches and Catholic churches went into Rwanda and were part of the healing and part of infusing that very broken and wounded society with a sense of grace, the Mormons come in, set up, and what they're doing is handing out the Sunday school manual that makes sense in the United States,
but not
no
dealing
space.
With the agony and the all of those questions.
No. So there are a whole lot of contextual questions, questions of politics and culture that never gets answered or addressed in contexts outside of the United States, which are pressing.
And the church offers a kind of remedy to that in its stability, in its access to global conversations, access to education in the past, especially in places like New Zealand and Mexico. But it doesn't, you know, the trade-off for people who then affiliate is that they have to set aside the most pressing questions to go on the Mormon plan. And they'll get some help from the Mormon plan, right?
But
it won't remediate some of the core woundings that created these situations.
Right. Yeah.
Are there other cultural dimensions beyond just the sort of social questions that they're dealing with? I'm thinking more cultural things like music that is expressed differently in different places. I'm thinking about also, and we'll come back to this, so I don't want to spend too much time with it now, but origin stories. If you become a convert to a very American Judeo sort of Christian idea, what are the cultural costs, I guess, and this maybe even the spiritual cost?
I mean, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, a long-time campaigners in New Zealand. So they arrive at the end of the 19th century. At a time where you've got a generation of people who are coping with huge amounts of land legislative violations to take their land. I think what it did in the beginning stages, where people were looking for a faith tradition and they were looking at the Church of England or the Anglican Church, who had been implicated in part of that land struggle, Mormonism was of huge amounts of appeal. Because at that stage, because it wasn't quite so highly regulated, they contextualized. Mormon missionaries learned the language. They were quite syncretic. Yes, we do ancestor worship as well. We've got the temple.
Prophets.
And prophets. And there is a prophetic sensibility in Māori culture. So it was quite appealing in that it got to be, there was a form of indigenization. And Māori liked it because you could track alongside the Mormon thing and the Māori thing.
You could be both.
Yeah. You could be both. And then we get into we get a change of mission president. And I want to say Gordon Clark replaced Matthew Cowley. Matthew Cowley was a great indigenizer. And then you get a series of other mission presidents who feel like their call is to straighten out Māori. And as Māori move into the cities and we become more bicultural as a church, the issue for them is to say, okay, well, we've got the majority culture, which is white. Is it fair to subject them to the brown indigenous, indigenized Mormonism? And you had people like Lawrence C. Dunn coming in and making these massive and violent decrees about you may not use the language, your funeral protocols need to now change. So there was this real pushing towards...
And language is huge.
Yes.
Language is massive.
Yeah.
Because the language entails the spirituality. So I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to make sure that gets underscored and really, go ahead.
Yeah, and there were decrees to say you couldn't use Māori in services now. And you lost a lot of very powerful Mormons who had to choose between, am I going to be part of this renaissance, a Maori renaissance, which is about revitalizing culture, because everybody knows that the firmer and the more deeply rooted you are in your culture, the more you're going to be able to thrive as a people. So, yeah, so back to your question, what's the effect? I think that people have had to do, it's the cultural tax that you pay with this either-or mentality, where there emerges out of this tension between what's coming from Salt Lake City and what's coming from the heart of a culture, like hierarchies of expertise, like this isn't Mormon and this is Mormon. So it required a lot of heartbreaking questions for Maori. Going
so
into the 21st
century. I wanted
century.
To ask you about In an Afterword, written by Jane Hafen.
Mm-hmm.
She writes about how the origins of Mormonism, as she puts it, collide with the origin stories of indigenous people. And I wanted to ask you about that. She says in the essay that a characteristic of sacred scripture is that it is true to the culture where it was created. But what does that mean for indigenous creation stories? Hafen says those are not thought of as quote-unquote true. They're thought of as myths or fables. So how does it work if you are an indigenous person, you decide you want to become Mormon, yet you have a culture that has an origin story? It gives you identity. Huh. Because Mormonism is not, it doesn't seem like to me anyway, a loose framework that you can just add your own story to. It has its own idea of this is where we came from, guys. And this is the moral behavior that we're approving here. And this is how deity works. So how do you ditch all the other stuff that doesn't conform to that? How does that work?
I think that you've got two approaches, and this is what colonized people have to deal with. Myths and fables are stories that are not true but are useful, or they are not real but are true. And you're always playing with that. There's a flexibility in playing with those stories. Nobody sits around and say, oh, that story, that creation story we have of about an earth mother and a sky father, is that actually true? We live into that story because that's telling us a lot about how to live in the present, in a cosmology. It's giving us huge amounts of wisdom.
It seems like such an American, maybe even Mormon thing to ask. Is that thing true? Did that thing actually happen?
Yes.
What you're saying is, who cares?
Yes.
It's a story that gives us identity and purpose.
Yeah, and a lot of white Western and American Mormons would benefit from that indigenous sensibility. They'd stop being agonizing over whether or not the story was true.
Yeah, yeah. But so how do you then negotiate that? How I guess here's the question. Does the church allow that?
Does the church allow it? I think it has points of resistance to it. You know, society goes in those flows where there's moments of awakening and let's bring these things together. And that changes the course of, that changed populations and population behavior. And then institutions like the church will notice it and come in and try and clamp it down. So I think wherever they go, that's the flux, that's the rhythm. And I think one of the most exciting things about looking outside of the American discourse or the American experience of Mormonism is to see the points of resistance. Because I don't think that if you cannot integrate an idea that comes from the United States, it's not necessary then. Like it becomes a cultural impossibility to include some ways of thinking and being, and that has no place in a global church. If we can identify those points of resistance, we can say, actually, this really doesn't have any place in a global church.
Well, I think, Doug, your question calls up and points to one of the major challenges that Mormonism has faced in the last 30 years. So basically, what is the Book of Mormon but an attempt to generate an origin story for the Americas, for the Western Hemisphere, right? Out of thin air, a new one. And that storyline was very important to many communities of indigenous people in Mexico, in South America, in the Pacific, in the desert Southwest. And then there comes a point, you know, 20 years ago where the DNA evidence is not holding up, and we are forced as a community, as an entire Mormon people, to sit with, you know, and the lore that we had generated around what it meant to be a Lamanite. And at the same time, the church starts pulling back heavily from its bureaucratic investment in programs aimed for, and no other mythology has succeeded it. We have not sorted that out, what it means to be post-Lamanite. you know, authors in our book, like Angela Baca, write to this really beautifully. Like, you know, what are you once the Lamanite myth or the Haygoth myth has been demarcated as questionable? Who do you become? Are you still special? I mean, the church made huge inroads into indigenous communities throughout the Americas and the global South with the story that indigenous people were of this destiny. And it has not provided a sequel that is tenable.
Gina, you write about this. You kind of liked the idea of being a Lamanite for a while.
Yes. It gave you a sense of exceptionalism.
Yeah.
It gave you a sense of belonging and place. I mean, this is a white church. But you had that tradition of missionaries going out into the Pacific and saying, you're part of this story. It makes you feel pretty special in nations ravaged by colonialism. But then what do you do with those stories when Native peoples start asserting their own themselves and owning their own stories? We call it, in the book, we call it a cultural prosthetic. Mm-hmm. It was good for a time. And I think it has huge benefits. I mean, if you look at the research, the demographic research for Māori Mormon in New Zealand, it's off the charts in terms of positive outcomes and well-being. So I'm not saying that the machinery has been, it's very good at social mobility, taking underclass and putting them in a working class.
Yeah.
But what happens in the next generations, mm-hmm. when it becomes very important for us to engage with and understand culture and language? And then you see, okay, these two things that I'm holding, the right. Latter-day Saint tradition and the indigenous tradition, are actually been warring for a long time. And you notice that. Mm. And so the space to speak back to the church about that kind of plunder that they do so seemingly innocently, taking away our stories. You know, we have to develop a sensibility to hear that. And this is the issue, I think. The huge issue is that everything comes from this place. It goes from center to margin. And we would be hard-pressed to say what's going from margin to center.
Right.
How is the experience of the most marginalized in this community affecting the experiences of the most privileged? And I would say that there are very few, because it's so top-down, this church, very few mechanisms make that available.
Gina Colvin, along with Joanna Brooks, they co-edited the book Decolonizing Mormonism. We'll take a break and be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West from KUER.
Do you have an old station wagon full of memories and a busted transmission? Yeah, join the club. Give that car, or any car, a new lease on life by donating it to KUER. We'll have it picked up for you, so really it couldn't be easier. Then we split the proceeds with our car donation partner, and the money goes straight into the programming you love to listen to in the car. It's a regular public radio circle of life. Look under the support tab at KUER.org to learn more about car donation.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about a book that asks whether the LDS Church really is an international church. Technically, of course it is, but more than half of the world's Mormons now live outside the United States, far away from the Intermountain West. So Joanna Brooks and Gina Colvin have put together a collection of essays called Decolonizing Mormonism. They joined us to talk about it. What did the 40th anniversary of the removal of the priesthood ban recently, what did that say to you about the way the LDS church leaders deal or don't deal with the issue? I mean, on one hand, you had this, you know, people talking about, look at this beautiful gathering we have of people of color and some acknowledgement of, you know, African-American culture and African culture here on stage. Here it is. But no word whatsoever about questions of an apology, dealing with the more painful parts of the past. No discussion, it seemed like, from leaders about those kinds of difficult things. And I'm wondering what you saw in that that makes you think about how this question could play out, the questions you're asking now.
So I'm going to draw a parallel, and I'm going to, you know, introduce it by saying the 40th anniversary is, I think, a great time of learning for all of us who seek a more progressive Mormonism, and it disclosed many conversations we need to have even amongst ourselves that we have not yet had. So, you know, when we think about an act of violence like banning members of African descent, Black African descent, from access to the temple and priesthood, we know that even when the ban was lifted, all of the mental, theological, bureaucratic infrastructure that made that kind of thinking possible and desirable didn't go away. All that infrastructure, all that mess in our brains that we were taught, all those stories, everything seeded deep into our curriculum for Sunday school and the way we run our organizations, none of that left just because the ban was lifted. None of that repair work was done. I don't know that anything that happened in the past year, except for some grassroots efforts, challenged the members, the white members who did this to ourselves and did this racism to, you know, our brothers and sisters, but also to our own minds. Nothing challenged us to reformulate all of it like it needs to be reformulated. One could watch B1 as people I love and care about who are very, very observant and very conservative Mormons did, and not feel a sense of call to do better. And we have to do better. Colonialism is parallel. There's an event of colonization. There's an event. Someone invades another country. Someone establishes a bureaucratic regime. And then there's an entire mindset, an entire way of seeing the world that comes with it, that makes that violence possible, that subsidizes it, and that is sown into the colonized, into the way they see themselves. Just because England is no longer governing India directly does not mean English ideas, bureaucracies, white supremacy is out of the mind of Indian people, out of the mind of the African peoples through the British Empire, also dominated and colonized. It's not. And there's a very complicated process of taking out the bad ideas about, you know, indigenous people and their shortcomings and why they needed colonization. We have not begun that work, scarcely, as a Mormon people, let alone as first worlders. You know, and that's what we're talking about. And that's what we've learned by watching the last year, is that even when we commemorate events and milestones, massive infrastructures of thought and belief that are poisonous to our faith remain in place unless we consciously choose to root them out. And hearing stories like in this book from people like Gina and beginning to understand how impoverished white people's worldview has been by our inability and our unwillingness and our arrogance to, you know, that we can't see and hear and give people at the margins a seat at the table where decisions are made. We lose so much by that. But until we hear these stories and voices like in this book, we can't even begin to glimpse how much we've lost.
I want to ask you about Zion, because this comes up in the essay that you both write together. You mentioned that you're not the first scholars to critique what you call the promise of Zion. And you refer to Hugh Nibley, for those who don't know. He's he was a beloved Mormon scholar who wrote about how Mormon doctrine has this unique belief Zion is possible on the earth and the church is under this obligation to be headed there. Like they need to be headed in this kind of direction. And you say in the book that Nibley's critique is a good framework for reading these essays. And I wanted to ask you about that, because Nibley, as you mentioned, he kind of regularly chastised the LDS rank and file for avoiding, as he put it, the mental work. Talk a little bit about that, if you would. Like, that this is an obligation of the rank and file to be thinking more expansively about these things.
I don't think the idea of Zion is without necessary critique in and of itself. And it's sure. A very Mormon way of understanding the kingdom of God. But I think it holds out a promise that motivated many early Latter-day Saints all over the world to say, actually, there can be a political and a social regime that is very fair, and it is social justice-centered, and it is very prophetic. I think I really am enthused by the idea of Walter Brueggemann, who says church, with its consciousness, needs to be that prophetic voice that stands outside of mainstream society and providing a godly critique of that. He calls that royal consciousness and calling out the ideas of empire. In many respects, I think Mormonism started with that kind of promise, that it was actually going to deliver something extraordinary and equal and would pay attention to the least and the lost and the lonely. That's where it got its spiritual energy from. And that's what people... early Mormons noticed. I mean, why do we have
It was
so many...
a critique.
Yes, it was.
It was a revolt against death. I mean, I think about Joseph's vision of Alvin and, you know, his dead brother. I mean, we were going to have a theology bold enough that said we will defeat death. And how could that not appeal not only to people like my ancestors who were displaced from England and their lives torn up as peasants in destructive ways, but then to all the indigenous people whose communities were completely torn up by colonialism? I mean, how could that vision of the lost being found and the brother being restored and of family bonds being repaired beyond death, how could that not appeal?
Yeah. And it was extraordinarily hopeful and grace-filled. And it was a rebellion against the generations of atrophy that was happening in the Christian church in Europe. And so it was saying, in many respects, the Book of Mormon to me is an indigenized or contextualized vision for Christianity that makes sense in these new spaces. So there's that.
Yeah.
And I think that we have the promise or the taste or the fragrance of Zion always on our lips. But we don't have the institutions that are committed to the creation of that. Because I think, in many respects, the LDS Church, in its effort to be relevant and in its effort to be financially and economically solvent, has given away a lot of the ideas of Zion and has developed a very heavy right-wing, capitalist, presidential, neoliberal.
And that was Nibley's critique,
ideology.
Too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
But aren't they just interested in being organized? Doesn't all of this seem really untidy to corporate leaders? Honestly, like, this is, how do we maintain this? I mean, you can't have someone in New Zealand who has an idea that's, I mean, take doctrine aside, we've got to keep the stuff reined in. I mean, it seems like they're deeply organized.
Why? Why does it need to be reined in?
Well, I'm just saying, I'm thinking that's what they think.
Yeah.
And I mean,
and that would be my question. Why?
Yeah, yeah.
What are you worried? What are you going to lose? Like, God is wild and unpredictable and one only needs to throw themselves into sacred text to see that.
But I wonder, though, Joanna, isn't the history of the church, have been times when the church said, look, you have personal revelation. You can have these revelations from God. And then there were moments when people went off the rails. They started having revelations for other peoples and they had
and
to,
still do.
And still do.
Okay.
And still do. No, it's true. So the idea of having to rein people in, I think there seems to be some sense that they're really worried about people going off the rails.
I just want to respond to that by saying that's because this is a policy-centered corporate organization that has lost its foothold into the idea of Christianity. I think Mormons can be Christians. There's very little about the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints that I see as Christian as an organization. I think it uses Jesus as a branding mechanism, but this is not to say that individual Mormons and Latter-day Saints can't actually be transformed by the idea of Jesus, but the issue is that there is no theology. So people are worried about all this kind of craziness emerging, and it happens. And it's just the way the Christian experience and accommodates
and
those
the hunger,
charismatic experiences.
Well, and the hunger for order, I think, is replicated down to an individual level. And so I think, you know, we've come to imagine that Zion is a very, very tidy and well-kept gated community somewhere on the East Bench, you know, furnished by Pinterest, you know, where everyone's safe and clean and happy. It's a white middle-class suburb. Zion is not a white middle-class suburb. It is not. It cannot be. Zion is a refuge. It is a place for the pure in heart. It is a place where none shall come to hurt or make afraid, you know, and we give away that promise and that challenge when we confuse order and bureaucracy with faith. And, you know, the LDS Church as a corporation came into being at a specific point in history and served a specific role, but it is only part of the Mormon movement, and the Mormon movement keeps moving, and it will keep moving. And that wildness is, you know, part of what a living movement has.
Is that the crucial question, whether or not corporate Mormonism can adopt a more wild perspective of and more expansive idea for the future?
I think, you know what, when we say wild, I think what it's suggesting is that we're afraid of something.
Yeah.
And so the question is, what are you afraid of and why are you afraid of it? And what would be the most gracious way of managing the thing that we're afraid of? How can we make space for it? Because it emerges anyway. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the kind of the wild stuff that's very oppressive, the kind of crazy Mormon stuff that happens every week, every Sunday,
okay,
across
right.
the desk.
Let's
and
reframe
in Sunday school,
wild.
High priest group leader.
Wild is the random stories we hear in gospel doctrine.
Right.
That's some wild. We got to stamp that out.
Right.
We need to, like, colonize these wild white people. I'm serious. And get all that terrible racist folklore out of their heads, because that's not corporate, right? That's not.
Yeah,
doctrine. But I mean, I love the question you said. She's in a course of study of divinity, and so she's had the opportunity to study missiology in other, you know, in other faith traditions, other denominations. And she told me about the question that is asked in other places: how is the Spirit moving where you are?
Yeah.
And we see some elements of the bureaucratic church, just from a very clinical point of view, like the emphasis on local councils. Like, that has a lot of potential if we can reframe the question of how is the Spirit moving where you are. Maybe general location, maybe general conference should be shot on location. I mean, because, you know, that strong visual, you know, like, how is the Spirit moving there, and how do we nourish that, you know, how does Mormonism exist to nourish the way the Spirit is moving in Botswana or in New Zealand, and to really speak to the hearts and really contribute to and supply the needs of our brothers and sisters there.
And also sensitivity to the policies that are imposed in these outlying areas. The question of tithing and the way that tithing has been constituted very much suits an American, a U.S.-centric kind of economy. It is not something that you can manage in places where we have high tax rates.
Yeah.
So you have people who were on marginal tax rates of 67% having to pay, feeling like they have to pay 10% of that gross. And having to go to fast offering because they're not reliably and sensitively managing the impact of these seemingly innocent policies.
Gina, you write about, I wanted to ask you about what you describe as your unique spiritual legacy as a Mormon and as a Maori. You write about that you, for example, dream of mythical lizards and that you make ritual calls to the deceased beyond the veil and that you sprinkle yourself with water after leaving a cemetery or touching the dead. And, like, how that fits with Mormonism, because you write this: in being more than one thing, I extinguish the need for certainty, and in living out my life without rigid dualities, I become.
Mm.
Talk a little bit about that, because it seems like you say your identity as a Mormon and as a Maori has required integration and adaptation. I mean, how do you do that? How have you managed to do that?
I think it's a question of spiritual artistry, which I do think that we're all called to. How do we create something out of the parts of self? Living into a single story of self at the expense of our own ongoing development in terms of our identity is like asking us to sever limbs of self. So we kind of, you know, when you do the LDS thing, you're taking off a lot of cultural limbs. When they say you may not use the Maori language, or you may not make reference to the treaty, which is a really important political document in New Zealand, you're taking off parts of the self to enter into that. And I suppose for me, it's a bit of activism. So you don't get to dictate how I organize, how I think about, or the affection that I have for the LDS Church or other faith traditions that I percolate in. Mormon Church is it's a nothing in New Zealand. It's barely makes a blip on the religious sort of scale. And so there's that. And then being Maori at the same time, being assertively 100% all of these things.
Yeah.
Suddenly you're not chopping in, taking parts of the self off. And what floods into that, into the in-between space, is newness, is new creation and wisdom and becoming. I think it's a very masculine thing. I don't mean to be offensive to you as a man, but it's a very masculine thing to say, choose one or the other. Go to be Mormon or be this. Be left or right. Just choose all the time. And I think it's a very feminist thing to say, actually, I'm going to weave parts of parts together.
I wanted to ask you both about how other communities are developing their identities. They, as you say in the book, that Polynesian and Latino and African-American Mormons have established their own distinctive communities and, as you put it, and ways of being Mormon.
So whether they're getting permission to do this from the corporate headquarters, they're doing it anyway. What does it look like? I mean, what are you seeing, I guess?
Oh, I want to talk to the question you mentioned. What does it look like in terms of Maori context? And what does it mean to make ritual calls to the dead? And I think there was an effort in the 1960s and 50s to tidy this up. And there were historical battles over where bodies would be. The Mormons would take it to the chapel and the meeting house, and it would sit overnight, and the local Maori would steal the body and take it back. You know, so it was quite the thing. And they wanted us to empty our funereal protocols to something that was recognizable for Wasatch Front Mormons. And there was huge resistance to that. And I think now what's happening is people have just given up the fight because Māori are going to do it anyway.
Yeah.
Well, and I think too, Doug, so Mormonism has lived, you know, one has a relationship with the corporate church, but one also lives it in a kinship community. We have powerful kinship networks, right? We forge with others by attending church schools and growing up in a certain ward and a certain stake and, you know, going on missions. And so we, African-American Mormons have kinship communities, kinship networks, through which they make sense of and develop their own stories, their own memories, their own histories. Latino Mormons, you know, who grew up in the U.S., have a specific set of experiences and memories and code words and relationships that are rich to them and as meaningful to them as mine are to me, growing up as a white Mormon girl in Orange County and going to BYU and living that sort of I-15 corridor. So we have to recognize that some of what gives Mormonism its vibrancy is how robust these local kinship networks are and how we have Mormon memories, and they are specific to places, no matter if you're a Utah Mormon or an Idaho Mormon. There's different flavors everywhere, and those give our community strength. And so it's hidden in plain sight, right in front of our eyes. Our brothers and sisters of color are living Mormonism in their own ways and their own kinship communities, as well as within a bureaucratic structure. Right?
That's right, yeah. And there's a really great reflex among these communities just to ignore things and carry on the way you want to go
That's
on.
Right. That's right.
You mentioned a number of obstacles to having a more expansive view of all of this within the sort of institutional corporate church. One is this adoption of these management practices. We talked a little bit about that. But the other thing you say is and one of the obstacles is the sacralization of management is being reinforced as this ideology of faithfulness. What do you mean by that?
Well, the phrase ideology of faithfulness comes from a really, really powerful scholar named Hokulani Akau. I mean, Akau, right? Did I say it right?
Akau. Okay.
Yeah. And, you know, she writes about this in her work, in her book-length work, A Chosen People, A Promised Place, on Hawaiian Mormons. And she talks about how the church, when it came to the North Shore of Oahu, was a powerful resource for indigenous Hawaiians, for Kanaka Maoli, who wanted to protect sacred places and sacred gardens, sacred water sites. But at the same time, it leveraged an expectation that when management spoke on some issues, people would fall in line. And that sense of faithfulness as a, you know, that command performance of assent. Indigenous folks in Hawaii, according to her book, understood they had to assent sometimes in order to get what they needed to take care of what they needed to take care of.
Yeah.
They had to, like you said, you know, sometimes show up and say yes so they could continue have access to and then ignore on other parts and use the resources as they knew they needed to fulfill their obligations as
the
people
in that
place.
This was a compact, you say.
An unspoken compact, right? And so that's where that comes from. And the church commands that kind of assent from anyone who seeks to work within its networks and administer its programs. And many, many people at the margins make the choice to go along with it, some wholeheartedly, but some, you know, with sort of a brokered negotiation of how do I do this and simultaneously maintain my obligations to my funeral traditions, to my family, to my tribe, to my place.
Another one of the obstacles is this resistance to self-criticism. Is that worse, or is it always kind of been that way? I mean, what you're talking about is that you're trying to decolonize Mormonism, right? That's in the title, and the idea is that this is a critique, that we're supposed to be having this difficult conversation, but if there's a resistance to this kind of self-critique, or I mean, that's a problem.
Indeed. And it raises the question, what are we protecting? What is it about the Mormon experience or its theological assertions that we're trying to protect by not allowing the winds of the Spirit to blow through and renew the church? I mean, we talk about restoration. and restoration, as in reformation, must continue. So I think in many respects, I fear, because I'm not quite sure what's at its theological heart. So we've gone from that vision or that hope of Zion, which we sing so, we grew up singing these songs of Zion. But where is the theology of that now? Where is it? I don't know where it is. And what is replacing Zion is this lockstep hierarchical relationship with authority figures to whom we are required to outsource our spirituality. And if there is an antithesis of the idea of Zion, it's that. It's that these false promises of spiritual prosperity because of obedience. That's not Zion.
There's another obstacle you mentioned, the decline of indigenous Mormons, that there seem to be fewer of them interested in all of this. Is that that's a problem, especially when you're trying to jumpstart a conversation among indigenous people and others for all of this?
I'd say a problem for whom? I mean, Mormonism made a huge impact at a really important time in the histories of tribes in the Americas and beyond, when communities were, as Gina talked about, the Maori Renaissance, communities were reconstituting themselves. And there was sort of an infusion of access to education and that came through Mormonism. But as communities have the resources to do for themselves,
they don't need Mormonism anymore.
Well, if the church can't say to them, how is the spirit moving where you are?
Yeah.
If the church can't say that, why the spirit's going to continue to move in these places. I am totally confident of that. I'm confident that God is at work wherever people are rebuilding themselves and their communities and nourishing each other and seeking transcendence and seeking love and peace, that God is at work there. What does Mormonism miss out on if it can't even see that, if it can't embrace that? There's a story in the book that really struck me and stays with me. So Angela Baca, who is a filmmaker, he's Navajo Hopi, he writes about when he went and did baptisms for the dead as a kid, as a Navajo kid, as an LDS Navajo kid. And, you know, after doing this, the sacred ritual, you know, and they were treated sort of a little bit coldly by the temple staff, who I'm sure had all the prejudices that are normal to white people in a border town or in a res town, right? They were asked, the people who had done the baptisms were asked to buy lunch in the cafeteria. And he said, this is, to a Navajo, this looks crazy. Feasts as places to bring a community together, to honor the dead, to affirm relationships, feasts and generosity. That's at the center of Navajo spiritual life, of many traditions. And he is being charged money, cash, as a Navajo kid to buy some meal from some nice old lady who made it in a temple cafeteria. What is that? What does that say about us? And how much richer, that's the most superficial example, but, you know, how much richer Mormonism would be if it could take that information in and absorb it and use it as a point of self-reflection and improvement. And who are we if our religion is not about challenging ourselves, about challenging our arrogance, challenging our participation in violence that has made the lives of our Black and Brown brothers and sisters very, very difficult? Who are we if we're not fostering that? And I think that's, if there's something the bureaucratic church can do, it can sow into its curriculum and its workings that sense of reflection and humility. And that's a step that's yet to take.
Gina, you wonder whether in your essay, whether the white Utah church will ever soften enough to admit the stories and narratives from beyond their borders.
Mm.
At this point, looking at it now, what do you think?
Well, I mean, I think it's worth a lament that all of these stories, I mean, I grow up with the rich experiences of many, many extraordinary Maori women who really, in many respects, took me aside and said, you don't need to do that. So they gave me all kinds of permissions. Don't do that. Don't do that. That's what white people do. Just don't do that. I mean, I had this really wonderful experience of an older Maori sister in the ward, and the lesson started with a quote from Bruce R. McConkie, and she raised her hand amongst a whole other group of Maori women and said, no, please don't read his quote. I don't like him. And all of these other women said, yeah, no, we don't like him either. And so the teacher just closes, oh, sorry about that, and carried on. So we have all of these lovely points of resistance. And I think that the LDS Church should become influenced by these points of resistance. Offer the opportunity to speak your story and be willing to be changed by that story. But I think Mormonism is currently shackled. I fear that it's getting worse, mm-hmm. as the LDS or the United States political situation is getting more polarizing. I think that there is very little. It's so concerned with itself and its own politics. I think in many respects, going to the decentering the cogency, the supposed political cogency of the Wasatch Front Mormon dialogue, and just collapsing it and saying, you know what, this isn't going to help us. We're just going to go around and the church will implode and our communities will implode, because it's untenable to imagine that the markers for Mormon identity are whether or not you're a Republican or a Democrat. Like, it's a nonsense, and it just doesn't wash outside. So what's happening outside? What's happening? You know, when we've got in New Zealand, we have a former Mormon as our prime minister, a female who has just given birth to an out-of-wedlock child, you know, and she's doing extraordinary things. And I look at this woman, Jacinda Ardern, and I think she's able to do this because of Mormonism, yep. But she couldn't stay in Mormonism.
Yes, that's it.
So that's the question. Like, what is it? What talents and skills and abilities is it giving us? And why can't it hold people like Jacinda Ardern?
You say, Gina, you don't think the answer to the church's greatest challenges are going to come from Utah or from white folk.
No, no, they're pretty untrustworthy. Think about it. How many years have we been at this? I mean, you know, if you
want... We need help. No, we need to help ourselves and listen.
Yeah, I think as the United States political situation comes to the point of admitting humbly that maybe manifest destiny and American exceptionalism hasn't worked, then maybe culturally the church will soften enough to say, but what might work? Let's ask someone in Botswana or Kenya or Western Nigeria.
That's Gina Colvin and Joanna Brooks. They co-edited the book Decolonizing Mormonism. Radio West is a production of KUER News. We had technical direction from Tim Slover, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Thank you.